Do you miss me tonight? Are you sorry we drifted apart? Does your memory stray to a bright summer day when I kissed you and called you sweetheart? Do the chairs in your parlor seem empty and bare? Do you gaze at your doorstep and picture me there? Is your heart filled with pain? Shall I come back again? Tell me, dear, are you lonesome tonight? I wonder if you're lonesome tonight. You know, someone said the world's a stage and each must play a part. Fate had me playing in love with you as my sweetheart. Act one was where we met. I loved you at first glance. You read your lines so cleverly and never missed a cue. Then came act two. You seemed to change, you acted strange, and why I'll never know. Honey, you lied when you said you loved me, and I had no cause to doubt you. But I'd rather go on hearing your lies, baby, than to go on living without you. Now the stage is bare, and I'm standing there with emptiness all around me. And if you won't come back to me, then they can bring the curtain down. Is your heart filled with pain? Shall I come back again? Tell me, dear, are you lonesome tonight?
This is WHFR Dearborn. Stay tuned now for the next hour. Local news and views on the new WHFR Journal. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. This is Jay Koronick with you today here in the WHFR studios at Henry Ford Community College. You know, we are the station making waves, WHFR.fm. And hey, what about that election? In the studio with me today is Ned Apigian. So, Ned, did you survive the election? Did you have to stand in line for a long time?
Actually, being an elderly gentleman, I get to vote absentee.
Okay, so you voted weeks ago. Yeah,
I survived.
Let me just ask you a little question about that, and that is that in the weeks since you voted absentee, was there any particular election contest, that you might have voted differently on if you would have waited to the last minute?
I don't think so. I think I was pretty well. I didn't think anybody showed me something new in the last week or
okay.
so.
Okay. Because especially here in the 19th District Court area, I don't know if in your district you had to vote on the Summers Abbott judge
election. No, not election. Not in Dearborn Heights.
Because the challenger, Candace Abbott, sent three, count them, three separate large glossy mailings that all arrived on the same day, 3 days before the election, the Saturday before the election at my house. Now, that wouldn't have changed my mind because they were all negative ads. In other words, they were all negative towards the other candidate, the incumbent Judge Summers, who did win. We do have the election updates here, folks, for the Dearborn area. We're going to go down that list real quick in a second. But as I mentioned last week, if I would have waited, there were some minor races, relatively minor, but two I would have changed my mind on if I would have waited to gather more information.
So countywide issues? Or
I'm not saying. But it's not major races, but I'm saying there were things I found out. And I have told, I mean, always do what I say, folks, not necessarily what I do. I have told people locally that they really, if they get the absentee ballots, they should wait until just a few days before the election, continue to read the newspapers, continue to try to maybe catch those candidate debates on cable television, find out more, because sometimes at the last minute, you will change your mind because you have more information. And so you shouldn't vote too early. I know some people, as soon as they get that absentee ballot, there's all that excitement. Oh, I'm going to vote right now. And they turn it around, they get it back in the mail. And that might be as much as 3 or 4 weeks ahead of the election. And there's so much more, there's so many more chances, including these last minute direct mailings. Although, as I said, with the Abbott mailings, I totally rejected their premise, just because I will not respond to negative campaigning. I know most people do. Oh, I'm not going to vote for that other person because he sleeps, you know. And we know which candidate was the sleeping candidate. Well, and they did lose, by the way. That was a U.S. Supreme Court judge race. And Diane Hathaway won with that negative ad, I think, primarily pointing out how at least one time a judge nodded off during a case and then...
That was the only thing I saw on her behalf, to tell you the truth.
I saw some other positive things from other people that were supporting her, and
I agree with you absolutely, and I'll tell you why that happens. Being a candidate and having to respond to that is cumbersome. Mm-hmm. The state requires county and city clerks to mail ballots on a certain date before the election. And that's the reason for this problem. And it really causes the candidates to have to respond to that mailing. So if you're an amateur, you have to be ready.
Well, a challenger.
A challenger. At least, yes. A challenger. Exactly. An amateur, a challenger.
Well, it costs both candidates. The incumbents, of course, have the name recognition value, so they never have to spend as much as any challenger, typically. If you want to be successful as a challenger, you almost have to spend three times as much money to get rid of the incumbent.
Also, the endorsements help for incumbents.
Well, of course, yeah. But in a way, because of the absentee ballots, and especially in Dearborn, so many seniors or people over 60 avail themselves of that option, which I think is a fine thing to do. Although I was a little scared last Monday night when they were tabulating Dearborn, I was watching Mayor O'Reilly. He had a cable TV show on here for 90 minutes on election night, Tuesday, and they said, yeah, here are all the numbers except for the absentee ballots. And I'm thinking, but they had these like weeks ago. They don't
count absentee ballots.
No, they wait till the last 8 minute.
8 o'clock after the election.
However,
that much I know.
They were having machine reader problems because the absentee ballots require a bigger reader in order to be processed, and it didn't even look like they were going to get counted that night. It wasn't until close to 11 o'clock at the end of the show that, okay, now we have the numbers. And almost 9,000 people in Dearborn, almost one-third, I think, of all the votes cast in Dearborn, maybe one-fourth, were absentee ballots. And so I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I did absentee ballot. They're not even going to be able to read them. I had to count them by hand for days or something. As it turned out, the reader started working, and it didn't make any difference to the outcomes of the races. In other words, the absentee ballots, very interestingly, seemed to break down somewhat equally in terms of the races, and the same people who were projected to win.
The same percentage.
The same percentage, right, of those who were projected to win with the Tuesday ballots. Well, it didn't make a difference.
That's unusual. Being a candidate myself, let me tell you why. Because the absentee voters are generally elderly voters. Mm-hmm. They tend to vote more than other people, and they tend to vote issues that are closer to their pocketbook than other people.
Yeah,
but there's another thing about absentee voters that the average person needs to know. the assumption that all old people absentee vote is wrong. I learned that the hard way. You have to mail. What I used to do, I used to assume if I mailed to the absentee voters, I was getting them. But you have to look at the ages. So I learned to mail to people over 60 or over 50 and take them who, and you would be surprised how big that list is, that are not absentee voters.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a surprise to me, and I think probably the average listener would find that interesting as well.
I would think.
Some people like to go to the polls.
Yes. Well, it is fun. And in Dearborn, there really weren't any long lines, unlike what I saw on television.
In Detroit. There were.
Wow, there was one. The helicopter shot showed them waiting for like 3 blocks outside down the sidewalk. It was unbelievable. But in terms of Dearborn, let me go through this. This is from the pressandguide.com, pressandguide.com, one of our two weekly newspapers, and they have all the numbers, all the breakdowns for at least the major candidates anyway. I do fault them, but it is true that it looks like even the clerk's offices did not count or tabulate or pass along any of the Green Party, Libertarian, or other party numbers. And we know there were some people, like myself,
you'll probably see that
made some
week.
Of those votes. Yeah,
you'll probably see that next week.
I don't know if it was just a time-saving thing. If it's going through those electronic readers, though, they know the numbers. They just
That's
don't pass
true.
Them along.
Yeah.
It's just like I did criticize last week, too, on the 2 hours of the journal show that we had last Friday, election special edition, neither one of the papers seemed to make any effort at all for so-called third-party candidates. And they used to. They used to. And I think that's the influence of the so-called horse race mentality of the cable TV news channels that heck with. Nobody's interested in the people who are third or fourth or fifth. So we won't even cover them. Won't even talk about them. Won't even give them any time to make their case. And that is a tragedy. That's a shame in a democracy. And both of the local papers let us down. And even,
well, hopefully, you know, all the major politicians have to look at those numbers to see what they mean to them.
Yes, of course.
Well, hopefully we'll get it, so we'll see what it means.
Well, I watched Mayor O'Reilly and his 90-minute election night special that was on cable television, local access, CDTV, as they call it, City of Dearborn Television.
Is that Channel 16 or 12?
It varies if you're in. Yeah, it's either 10 or 12, depending if you're watching on WOW or on Comcast in Dearborn.
It's 18 in Comcast, I think.
Yeah.
In Dearborn Heights is 12.
Well, whatever it was, I did watch that show live, and it's interesting that there were so many straight party voters, because that has not been a trend in recent years, that people would, you know, maybe vote for someone for president, but a different party for governor or a different party for local
elected. So the statistics show there was a lot of that.
Oh, tremendous number of straight party ballots. And, of course, in Dearborn, and Mayor O'Reilly was somewhat surprised, is that it was about the same percent as in the state that went for Barack Obama at the top of the ticket.
So we think it was favorable to Democrats?
Yeah, I think because Obama was at the top, a lot of people took maybe what was the easy way out and said, we're going to vote Democratic, to the Democratic Party. And so Dearborn went about two-thirds Democratic. It was Barack Obama 65% to John McCain, Sarah Palin 32%. So if you add those up, that is 86%. So see what I'm saying? There's 14% here in Dearborn for some other candidate or candidates, and we don't know what that is now.
Well, the total voting, as I read in the paper, was 68% in the state of Michigan. The highest turnout was 73%.
Well, that's different. That's a votes cast I'm talking about here. A votes cast, 65% in Dearborn for Obama-Biden, and then 32.8% for John McCain-Sarah Palin.
So you don't think the 14% represents no vote? Any portion?
Oh, no,
of
no.
There's some.
No. There might be that somebody left that blank. It's possible. But I'm sure that there were votes for the third party candidates that just were not reported at all.
I'm surprised the percentage was that high. I thought the Republicans in Dearborn would be a little higher than that.
Yes. Well, and typically, sometimes Dearborn goes more Republican than Democrat, even though the state might go Democratic for governor or whatever. And that's why O'Reilly was somewhat surprised with the high number of Democratic votes in for Obama and and straight party Democrat votes, too, all the way down.
I think the Democrats are more energized in this race. That's the reason for it.
But he mentioned, and I believe this, too, is he said, I thought it was very bold of him, he never, Mayor O'Reilly never votes straight party. Okay? Someone is trying to call in to WHFR right now in the studio, and I don't know if it's about something Ned or I said, but I just want to mention the phone number here, but we can't take calls because we're talking right now. You could use, you can call back and use option two. I think we have someone at the front desk right now that Caroline is out there, and so she could take a written message and then bring it in to us. So or that number is 313-845-9676, and option two is the front desk if you do want to get a message right now to Ned and I, although we don't, we have some other things in the program we want to include today.
They might call while the Nader U of M tape is on.
This is not, this is not a talk show or a call-in show, folks, and just usually because we don't have anyone to answer the phone. And screen the calls. A lot of people don't know that call screening is important.
Yeah, we don't have call screeners.
No. And it's not caller ID, but we need to find out what you want to talk about in advance before we put you on the air live
so
to the whole city.
So we can have our finger on the dump button.
Well, we always do that anyway. But so that was interesting is that he said, and I highly recommend this, if you just can study and know enough to make an educated vote, just because people are in a certain party doesn't mean they're all good candidates for any particular office. And so the straight party voting is not a good trend, I don't think.
I don't do it, even though I may vote for everybody that's on the...
I agree with the mayor. I don't do it that way either, because if I look at the candidates as well as, you know, what they stand for, supposedly, through their party affiliation, I will still vote for a great candidate. It depends
on
the office.
In fact, I didn't, actually, now that I think about it. I did make some differences.
Yes, there you go. Okay. And in terms of who won... And this is very amazing to me because we do have a lot of Democratic representation here in Michigan. Senator Carl Levin, John Conyers, John Dingell, David Nathan, all the incumbents got in because we had a lot of Democratic incumbents.
The Democratic
for national office. Yeah.
The Republicans lost two seats.
But no one seemed to see the argument that if they say, well, the economic crisis and the war crisis was blamed on Bush and was blamed on, therefore, the Republicans. Guess who supported most of those things? The $700 billion bailout, the start of the war in Iraq. Democrats. So in a way, although nobody saw it that way, everybody said, well, Republicans were mostly in power, so I'm going to vote them out and let the Democrats go in. The Democrats had power in the legislature for the last 2 years, didn't do anything to change any directions, didn't stop the economic crisis from happening. And so there you go.
Because they knew they couldn't. Mm-hmm. They didn't bother, I guess.
Right.
Anyway.
So we did have a phone call here.
Good. We had a message. Anything interesting?
Well, it would encourage us to take calls, but again, we don't have the facility to take calls. But
that would be another kind of show.
He mentioned about the third votes.
Yeah.
He's a third party voter.
Right, yeah, and absolutely, Matthew, thanks for the point. Yeah, a lot of people in Dearborn were, and we don't have the numbers on that. I really made an effort to look, although I didn't call the city clerk's office. They probably could have told me that over the phone, and we'll try to get that for next week. As I said, it looks like 14% on just the presidential race here in Dearborn voted for someone other than the Democrats and the Republicans. So that's a very, very high number for for third party, probably third party candidates. And we'll get that
there. Percentage increases as you go down the ballot because people don't vote for everything in the ballot.
Right, yeah, and there's actually fewer people that, I mean, some people will just vote, they won't use the straight party thing, they'll only vote for those they know, and when they get further down the ballot, well, I don't know difference between the Dems, they won't vote at all. So the numbers actually decline there. But on the big, your concern was, very briefly, and then we're going to go to a very special speech from Ralph Nader that we weren't able to get on last week. It's not sour grapes, folks, it's not a campaign speech, it's Ralph Nader's analysis of the situation here in Michigan. From his speech at the U of MD last Friday. We're going to put that on in just a moment, and it runs 30 minutes. Andy Dillon did not get recalled, and he did not, and he did win his reelection.
What was the percentage in the recall in the election? Was it close, the same, or completely different?
Okay.
It sends a different message.
Right. He did get reelected by 66% to 33% for the Republican, 1% for
Eggers was her name.
Yeah. And where was the recall numbers? I thought that was in here. I'm looking.
I bet you that recall number is closer.
It's a similar. No, I don't think so. I don't think it was.
It's just the nature of
Here it is.
The bad campaign.
It's a little bit lower, not much. 62% said no, don't recall him, and 37% said yes. So instead of 66% that said he should be reelected, 62% said no. So
it's a lot higher than I suspected.
The recall was a little bit lower. I don't know if that's significant, folks. It might have taught him a small lesson.
It's confusing to the voter.
Well, the recall, you understand, would only have given him 2 months off if he got reelected.
That's right.
So you want to slap him on the wrist a little, or do you want to get him out of there totally?
I think it confuses confused.
It
about
was,
the
but you know, because of legal challenges and that, they didn't get the recall on the ballot until this time.
Right.
It could have been on the ballot in August. So there you go. In Dearborn Heights, they asked for a restoration of millage proposal for building and site sinking fund for the schools, and you voted it down. Shame on you.
District 7, I think that
Yeah, District 7 only. Right, you're right.
Only. There's several districts.
It was 58% said, no, we're not going to restore to fix our buildings and our school sites, and 41% said yes, so that went down. However, in District 7, again, an operating millage proposal for non-homestead and qualified cultural agricultural, which I think is like farms or whatever.
You have to explain that to the people.
Well, the majority of people voted, because it wasn't them, the majority of people own homestead. They own their own private property to live there. Non-homestead would be the people that own apartment buildings. So it was just a small group, but unfortunately it wasn't voted on by them exclusively. It was voted on by the whole District 7 and District 7. Yeah, make them pay a little more.
People that own the second home.
Yeah. Well, maybe. Non-homestead would be a second home. Yeah.
Or a two-family
rental
house.
Rental, right? It could be, yeah.
I don't think there's many of those in Dearborn.
And not here in Dearborn, but Wayne County Community College district millage was renewed. But Dearborn, we have our own community college here, of course, Henry Ford, so we're not part of that.
Except the Fairlane district in Dearborn Heights.
In Dearborn Heights, the vote was no.
No.
But it was approved by the rest of the county. Yeah, so... Just and of course we supported again, like I said, like it did in the state. We supported Proposal 2 for human embryo and stem cell research, and also the use and cultivation of medical marijuana,
which, by the way, passed throughout the state. I don't know what's the percentage. I was reading. I know it passed, but I didn't get the percentage.
It's pretty significant here. And as I said, in Dearborn, it was 52. To 47 in favor of Proposal 2, stem cell research, and just like in the state of Michigan, a wider percent approved it in the state, 62% in Dearborn to 37%.
For medical marijuana.
It's very similar percentages in the state.
I thought it was much higher in the state, 52 Maybe versus 62 is 10 points.
This is 62 to 37, 62 to 37 for medical marijuana.
In the state.
In Dearborn.
Oh, in Dearborn.
And my recollection is, I don't have it in front of me, is that it was the same or maybe a little more statewide, but we were very comparable. I mean, statistically, within
a
few points
very surprising
of the whole vote in the whole state of Michigan. Yes,
that's surprising.
Yes. Yeah, so Dearborn, we didn't stand out, folks, but we went along with the view statewide, interestingly.
How about the stem cell research versus the marijuana? The same
percentage?
As
I said, it was a little tighter because of the, you know, is it
moral issue?
Yeah, moral issues involved. 52-47 for
closer.
Stem cell. It was closer, but again, it was also closer statewide, but it's still a significant approval.
What was it statewide?
Again, similar. I don't have those numbers in front of me, but similar. Okay,
everybody
clear on that? And, of course, the close race, the reason that we mentioned this too, well, first of all...
The
judgeship in Dearborn, 19th District. The incumbent, Mark Summers, was reelected, but it was so close that it was a difference out of about 34,000 people that voted in that race. It was a difference of only 228 people.
Isn't there an automatic recount based on the
No,
percentage?
It's not automatic at all. No.
Not in Michigan? We don't have that?
No, it's not automatic.
It's less than 1%?
Yes, it is. Yeah. 50.17% in favor of Summers and 49.5% for Abbott. And so that is a difference of only 0.67%. But there's no automatic recount there.
0.67%.
Yeah. So if you think your vote doesn't matter, and in these other races, one vote wouldn't have made a difference. But here, it was only 228 votes out of 34,000.
Right. Just stop and think of the Senate race in Minnesota and... Where were the other in Georgia and in where was the other one
right.
now?
Yeah, well, statewide, and I don't know how many votes statewide in Minnesota. That was for the Senate race.
Less than 300.
It was the
now.
Incumbent against Al Franken, who the comedian and radio commentator for Air America for the first couple of years, and he was running as a Democrat. So it's a Republican Democrat, very close. There was a large number of independents that voted for someone there too, and so that took some votes away from either one or the other candidate. I'm
first
not sure
I
which
heard
one
it was
but,
like 560 well, votes different. Last I heard, now it's
yeah, they're recounting, and there's
320 or something.
Now as of this morning, it's even closer, about 220.
Yeah, maybe it's.
But I think it's still the Republican in the lead, but we don't know about that.
Yeah, okay, so yes, it was.
We're going to go now, and we have to in order to get this in a very insightful analysis by Ralph Nader right here at University of Michigan Dearborn last Friday afternoon.
And the third party candidate, of course.
Well, he was, and he did get. It looks like nationwide only 0.5%.
Ooh.
But that's one person out of 200. Actually, of those voted, did, and he got, this is very interesting to me, before we play this, he got he got more votes than the Libertarian Party candidate, and they typically were the third largest vote-getting group, Bob Barr, running for president there, and the Green Party, according to what I saw on FoxNews.com, which was the only website that actually quickly tabulated third-party votes, not even a percentage for Green Party candidates.
So
Cynthia McKinney.
So it was Nader.
Nader came in third. He came in third for president of the United States, right. Even though it was only 0.5%.
Ahead of the Libertarian.
Ahead of Libertarian, and there was no votes reported on FoxNews.com for Cynthia McKinney.
Those other two are organized parties, though.
Well, they are parties, and the U.S. Taxpayers Party, Chuck Baldwin, didn't supposedly get it. Now, I think that's got to be wrong, and I'm looking for...
The Constitutional Party?
Yeah, the U.S. Constitution Party, which is Chuck Baldwin, and the Green Party. But they were not on in as many states as Ralph Nader. He was on the ballot one way or the other, not only in Michigan, but 44 other states. So he was on, and that's what counts, getting on the ballot.
Right.
He didn't get, of course, in the debates, as no third parties did. So that's, anyway, here's Ralph Nader speaking at U of MD last week about the situation in Michigan. And we'll be back in 30 minutes with more of the WHFR Journal live with Ned Apigian and myself.
It's a tough time because the executives of the major auto companies have failed miserably, except their own pay package. They failed their workers, they failed their shareholders, they failed the communities, because they took the easy way out, which is not to put their engineers and scientists to work to produce competitive motor vehicles, especially fuel-efficient motor vehicles with their Japanese and South Korean and European competitors. But they defiantly did that. They lobbied Washington for 30 years against our efforts, demanding no further increase in fuel efficiency standards from the one that was set in 1975 for a 27.5 mile per vehicle average fuel efficiency. For the automotive fleets. And then under Reagan, GM and Ford started getting exemptions even from that standard. Unfortunately, United Auto Workers sided with them. That's the one thing I've never understood about the UAW, why they side with the auto companies and make it impossible to get through Congress better fuel efficiency vehicles, without which you don't have as many United Auto Worker jobs. And so it's almost like they traded off for dwindling union membership with job security in return for making it impossible for environmental and consumer groups to prevail in Congress. Because when you're confronted with the auto industry lobbyists and the UAW, you can't win in Congress. So here we are with GM, Ford, and Chrysler having received $25 billion in low-interest loan subsidies from the U.S. government. This went through Congress a few weeks ago without a single hour of public hearing. That's the way they do things now. I think they've learned from King George III. It's called taxation without representation. When the Chrysler bailout was underway in 1979 for a modest $1.25 billion loan guarantee, they had days of public hearings. I participated in them, in the Senate, in the House, before it went through. And it went through with strict requirements, including that Lee Iacocca and Chrysler had to issue stock warrants to the U.S. Treasury so that if Chrysler recovered, which it did, the stock warrants would more than pay for the loan guarantee, and they were sold for $400 million in profit. This time, there were no stock warrants. It was very vague, supposedly pay for retrofitting factories to produce more fuel-efficient cars, but there's no requirement for that. As if that's not enough, Rick Wagoner, the CEO of General Motors, has been in Washington in the last few days trying to get $10 billion out of you, the taxpayer, to finance the merger of Chrysler and GM, which will unemploy, directly and indirectly, 90,000 workers. So look how grotesque it is. First, they support the efforts to block fuel efficiency standards and lead them in Congress. Then they get in trouble. Then they go to get to Washington for bailout number one, the loan guarantees. And then now they want us to finance their own mergers and unemploy 90,000 workers with $10 billion of taxpayer money. Who can think this up? It's hard even to make this up. Now, you say, well, what is the problem with Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler? The problem is that they have had leadership that is not in the tradition of automotive engineering. They're finance people. They're accountants. They're so-called business managers. They're not engineers. And they're way behind, obviously, the Honda and Toyota hybrid motor vehicles, and they're selling gas-guzzling monsters that people can't afford and don't want to buy anymore. And so they're in deep trouble, along with the communities here in Michigan, and it's going to get worse. Michigan has the highest unemployment rate in the United States. You have one of the highest uninsured population for health care. 13.4% uninsured, at least that much underinsured, and before we know it, you're going to be in a depression. The auto companies have been shipping jobs out of Michigan for years to Mexico, and now they're moving to other countries. They're outsourcing a lot of parts. They have no gratitude. That's the nature of global corporations. They rise to profit on the backs of American workers. They get bailed out on the backs of American taxpayers when they get in trouble in Washington. And when they get in trouble overseas, they what the government does to back them up. And what's their response to America? We're out of here with your jobs and industries. Where? To fascist and communist dictatorships who know how to keep their workers in their place, don't they? Now, how long are we going to be ruled by these plutocrats and autocrats, these corporate supremacists, as long as we let them? Last I heard, they don't have a single vote. We're the ones who have the votes. There are 535 men and women in Congress, senators and representatives, who put their shoes on like you and I do every day. The majority of them are swung into the direction of corporate demands by 1,500 or so corporations who get their way with the majority. They don't have any votes. They have power and money. But what is it that members of Congress want more than power and money? Wants our votes. Why do we give it to them? Why don't we condition the votes? Why do we have a voting population, half of whom stay home, don't vote, because they don't think it matters? And the rest go and vote for the least worst of the two parties. Michigan is turning into a colony. your courtroom doors are closing if you're wrongfully injured or defrauded. It has worse laws for consumers in Mississippi, which is saying something, given this was the home of progressive Democrats and United Auto Workers years ago. I know trial lawyers who aren't even practicing anymore. If they want to sue the auto companies, they have to do it in Illinois or some other state, because under John Engler and others, the legislature closed the doors on adequate awards for people who are injured by defective motor vehicles, hazardous drugs, toxic chemicals, you name it. Why should anybody think things are going to get better here in Michigan? Your universities are starting to suffer, especially the public ones. The state looks in bad disrepair. You just ride around the state, you probably have the worst cabs in United States history. And Detroit. I would get in a Detroit cab a few years ago, and I'd look down, and I'd see the road. And this is the auto capital of the world. You go to a place like Tokyo, and they got well-kept cabs, they're clean, drivers wear white gloves. Shabby. This is what happens when you live in a one-crop state. Any state that's dominated by one industry, whether it's the cotton plantations in the south, or auto companies here, or the copper barons in Montana, going to have an imbalanced economy, and not a very good one, and a boom and bust economy. So what do we do? Well, if the taxpayer is going to be asked to bail out the auto companies, here's what should happen. Number one, removal of the board of directors and the executives. They're the ones who caused the problem. There's no point giving them money to cause more problems.
What directors?
The board of directors of General Motors and Ford and Chrysler. The board of directors of General Motors keeps giving Rick Wagoner a vote of confidence. And he has now run this company into the ground. He's very congenial. And he sweet talks the board. But the stock valuation of General Motors is now $3 billion. You know what Toyota is? $160 billion. The stock valuation of GM is so low that I'm going to urge T. Boone Pickens, Warren Buffett, and George Soros to buy it and put it back into shape. Because if GM can become competitive again with fuel-efficient motor vehicles, safe motor vehicles that are easy to operate, the environmental movement will get a huge push, and T. Boone Pickens would get his dream realized. But just think, it's available for a bargain basement price, plus a lot of liabilities. But the liabilities are increasingly being handed off to the UAW, to the U.S. government. And once the sales turn around, you can have an ecological General Motors. It's not going to happen with the present management. It's a testimony to the fact that the shareholders have no control over the company they own, that these high executives have been running this industry into the ground year after year. And even when they were selling a lot of gas-guzzling SUVs, they knew that this was not going to last. They knew. It doesn't take a smart person to know that if gasoline prices go up, it's going to be trouble. So, removal of the board and the officers of the company. Any taxpayer injection would come with ownership, proportional ownership, held by stock warrants in the custody of the U.S. Treasury. And any tax injection has to be conditioned on changes that will increase the likelihood these companies will be turned around and start prospering. That means technological improvements in their products. It's all about product in the final analysis. People are not buying U.S. auto company cars because they're not as good. They go to the repair shop too often. They don't have the fit and finish. They don't have the kind of service. They don't have the fuel efficiency. And that's becoming quite clear. Toyota now has passed General Motors easily worldwide in sales, and it's beginning to catch up here in this country. Now, GM and Chrysler want taxpayers to fund their merger. Why is that merger going to solve anything? Sure, they'll have one sales executive instead of two, and so on. But why is that going to sell more cars? And how many places like Toledo are going to lose their plants? It's certainly not good for the workers. It's just a stopgap, band-aid measure to distract attention of the country from the bad management and the lousy products that they're producing. I want to make some comments on foreign policy in the Middle East. With the complicity of the Democrats, George W. Bush has been engaging in an aggressive criminal war occupation in Iraq, which is unconstitutional, violation of federal statute and international agreements. This makes him an authentic war criminal. He has not been impeached because the Democrats who took control of the Congress in January 2007 stated right at the outset that impeachment was off the table, thereby violating their oath of office to enforce the Constitution, which includes the impeachment provision. Because everybody knows who knows these people, knows that these Democrats believe that George W. Bush is a recidivist criminal and a promoter of high crimes and misdemeanor every day of the year. Systemic torture, high crimes one, imprisoning Americans, many of them Muslim and Arab Americans, without charges, denying them habeas corpus rights, putting them there without probable cause, high crimes and misdemeanor number two, the criminal war of aggression in Iraq, high crimes and misdemeanor number three, snooping on millions of Americans without judicial approval, high crimes number four, and signing bills from Congress in the dozens, saying he'll decide whether or not to obey them. He, King George IV. That's the fifth, high crimes and misdemeanor. These are not occasional ones. These are not a one-time Watergate burglary or lying under oath about sex like Clinton did. This is 24/7, week after week, month after month, year after year. And here he is. He'll leave office on January 21st, heading to Texas with his buddy Dick Cheney without any sheriffs in pursuit, even though the federal criminal laws apply to presidents, vice presidents, inside and outside of office. You know, when you snoop on Americans without a judicial warrant, that's a first-class felony with a maximum jail term of 5 years. Nobody's immune from that. So perhaps some district attorney or attorney general around the country will prosecute them after they leave as something that's clearly within American law. Less than you think that this opinion of violating the Constitution is a narrow one, the American Bar Association in 2005-2006, very conservative, a lot of Republican lawyers, sent Bush three reports charging him with serious systemic violations of the Constitution. He never bothered answering. This is a rogue presidency. It's out of control. It's an outlaw presidency. And it's the forever shame of the legal profession that, with a few exceptions of a few lawyers and the head of the American Bar Association in 2005-2006, they have not done a thing about it. Now, let's take the Palestinian-Israeli issue. Barack Obama and McCain, by the way, have no intention of getting out of Iraq. They'll reduce the number of soldiers, keep the corporate contractors there, keep our bases there, and call it withdrawal. That's why the Iraqi government is freaking out. They want us out of there by 2011. They want their country back. They want their oil back. They want us to get out of their backyard. A million of their citizens have died since we invaded. Compare that with the casualty levels in other countries when we've invaded. It's one of the worst. 4,200 of our soldiers, 100,000 of our soldiers injured, 4,200 have died, most of them low income, poor whites, Latinos, African Americans. On Palestine, Israel, McCain and Obama go to the AIPAC convention, get on their knees, and read their recited lines. Now, AIPAC does not represent majority Jewish American opinion. They are the hardline military approach by the Israeli government, brutalizing, occupying, invading, and colonizing Palestine and Palestinians, including taking most of their water. That's not generally known. Stealing most of their water from the West Bank. Blockading Gaza, which is an international crime by all accounts. The UN thinks so. And where's Barack Obama and McCain? They're supporting the hardliners in a policy that will never solve that problem and resolve that conflict. So we, Nader Gonzalez, believe that if you want to solve that problem, you support the Israeli and Palestinian peace movements that have worked out in detail two-state solution over the years and has never been allowed a hearing in Congress. Isn't that interesting? Not a single hour of hearing has better ever been permitted. The peace movements in those two areas, even though that is a very serious conflict that's radiating far away from the borders of the Mandate of Palestine into Asia. It's interesting to know that when Obama went to Israel, he spent 45 minutes in the West Bank, refused to have a press conference, made no comment about the suffering of the Palestinian people and their displacement and the disposition of their lands, and went south to a small town in Israel that has had a few rockets from Gaza and expressed his sympathy with that town, but totally ignored that in the last year, the ratio of civilian casualties between the Palestinians in Gaza and the Israelis in southern Israel was 400-1. 400-1 civilian casualties. That's how the Palestinians have been treated. And what is their crime in the mind of Obama? That they're resisting? Wouldn't he resist? Wouldn't any American resist? Occupation, brutalization, dispossession, embargoes of medicine, water, food. Obama's a coward. I have accused Obama of anti-Semitism against the Arab peoples, which is exactly what he is. If the shoe was on the other foot, and he went to the Middle East, and he disregarded the plight of suffering Jews, if he turned his back on the plight of occupied, repressed, colonized, brutalized Jews, he would be considered anti-Semitic. Against Jews. Well, the Arabs are part of the Semitic races. In fact, they outnumber the Jews as part of the Semitic race. And any bigotry against the Arabs will be called and should be called anti-Semitism against Arabs. Finally, we have to demilitarize our foreign policy. The brute force foreign policy of George W. Bush with the complicity of the Democrats in Congress isn't working, shouldn't work, will not work. As Ashraf Ghani, who was the finance minister for Karzai in Afghanistan, said when he was asked, what do we do about Afghanistan? He started out saying, here's what we do. Justice is the basis of all social order. And that's the opposite. Bush believes in brute force. One additional point. How many times have you heard John McCain say patriotism, honor, loyalty, duty to country and to our members of our armed forces. Every day? Well, he has approved a few years ago the false report of his father, who was told by Lyndon Johnson and Secretary of Defense McNamara to absolve the Israeli military of their attack on the USS Liberty. A communication ship offshore during the 1967 Israeli-Egyptian war that was defenseless and on June 8th was attacked by Israeli planes, Israeli torpedo boats, Israeli helicopters, strafing, napalming, bombing, and shooting up the sailors. 34 died, 170 wounded. Just barely got back to port without sinking in Malta. It was clearly marked as a U.S. ship. The flag was there. The Israelis admit that they identified it earlier that day, but somehow they lost the location. And it was putting out distress signals as wave after wave of planes came in on that communication ship. It turns out the Israelis wanted to destroy it at the same time that the U.S. government was supplying Israel with emergency military material in its fight with Egypt. They wanted to destroy this ship because it had electronic gear and it could intercept military messages within the Israeli armed forces, for example, as to when and how they're going to bomb Syria. Immediately, Lyndon Johnson ordered a military court of inquiry. Now watch this. The attack was June 8th, 67. June 18th, Israel was exonerated in a report supervised by Admiral McCain, John McCain's father. Well, you can say, why do you hold his father's deficiencies for John McCain? Here's why. Number one, Secretary of State Rusk, the Chief of Naval Operations Admiral Maurer, and CIA head Helms believed it was a deliberate attack by the Israelis, not accidental. And number two, McCain endorsed a book of propaganda a few years ago that tried to show it was accidental and said, very thorough research, and you have supported my father's report exonerating the Israeli military. Now, is that duty to country? Is that loyalty to the men and women of our armed forces? There are bereaved families who have been demanding the truth come out for 41 years, including the survivors of the Liberty attack. So I say to Senator John McCain, to whom is your loyalty? The hardline AIPAC lobby in Washington or to the U.S. Navy and the survivors and families of the USS Liberty? Do you think any reporter would ever ask McCain that question on the campaign trail? No. Third parties have a hard time having a chance to have a chance to appeal to the voters because, A, they're excluded from the debates, which are controlled by the two major parties. Therefore, you can't reach tens of millions of people. Every national poll wanted Ralph Nader on those debates since 2000, and I have been kept off. Therefore, you can't reach tens of millions of people. If you can't reach tens of millions of people on those debates, the national TV won't cover you in April, May, June, July, August, leading up to the debates. And then you're having trouble getting on the ballots because the two parties make it very expensive and very obstructive for their potential competitors to get on the ballot. So this is a two-party dictatorship. Let's call it what it is. It's funded by corporate money, and it is reducing dramatically any kind of elbow room for regeneration of American politics. It amounts to laughing at the voter, mocking the voter, and daring the voters to do anything about it. No other Western country ties up voters in knots the way these two parties do. And that's why we don't have the social benefits and the conditions for a good livelihood that Western Europe has, because they have a multi-party system. And for 50 years, they have had the following, which we do not have for all our people, 63 years after World War II. They have universal health care, decent wages, decent pensions, 4 weeks paid vacation. In Sweden now, it's 7 weeks paid vacation. They have university-free tuition. They have maternity, paid maternity leave, paid family sick leave, decent daycare, decent public transit, and well-maintained parks. 63 years after World War II, we have none of these for all our people. That's the condemnation of the two parties. 63 years, the Republicans and Democrats have refused to deliver the basic social benefits and decent standards for a productive economy, which is a reflection that the top 1% of the richest people in this country have financial wealth equivalent to the combined financial wealth of the bottom 95%. It's a big banana republic. That's what it is. And the workers are not getting their just desserts. This is not welfare we're talking about. We're talking about workers who work their heads off. They work longer hours than 20, 30 years ago. 47 million full-time workers, one out of every three, are making Walmart wages. They don't have full Medicare. They don't have full health insurance. They're making $7, $8, $9, $10, under $11 an hour before deductions. And that is not a living wage. The minimum wage now is much less than it was in 1968, when worker productivity was half of what it is today. You see how we're going backwards into the future. If the minimum wage was adjusted to inflation the way members of Congress adjust their salaries, it would be $10 an hour now. It's $6.55 an hour is the federal minimum wage. So until we get socially indignant, until we build a third political force, until we deny these two parties their vote, we will get worst of the same, not more the same, worst of the same. And they'll go back to Washington, laugh at us, break their populist promises, which you're hearing every day from Obama and McCain, and turn more of our government over to the corporate buccaneers, who now not only want our tax dollars, not only want deregulation, not only want the scuttling of health and safety standards for workers, environment, consumers, but they want to be guaranteed against their reckless greed and speculation by Washington bailouts. Now, until we apply what we know to our emotional intelligence and break our routines and support candidates like Nader Gonzalez, the bulk of the people in this country are going downhill. All the indicators are bad. You know them as well as I do. We're moving into a deep recession. Unemployment is increasing. Poverty is swelling rapidly. And we've got people sinking in a pit of debt. Our government has huge deficits, which they're passing on to your children and grandchildren. So we urge you to go out and get out to vote. Talk it up. The more votes we get, the more strength we have when we go back to Washington to be a watchdog and a hammer on these two parties. The more votes we get, the more people will be encouraged themselves to run for local and state office. The more votes we get, the more young people will go into clean politics because we've set a standard for them. And the more votes we get, the more likely there'll be a major decisive political force in the coming years. So our votes are pioneer votes. They're not scared votes. They're not least worst votes. They're not hereditary Democrat and Republican votes. They are pioneer votes of conscience and of protest. The two go hand in hand.
We were listening for the last half hour to the speech that Ralph Nader, a famous consumer advocate for more than almost 40, 50 years now, very significant in the history of the United States. In the last 100 years, both Time Magazine and Forbes Magazine have said he's in the 100 most significant individuals in America. And And he spoke here, and that was his analysis of the situation, especially in Michigan. Of course, he did not get a very large percent of votes. We don't know exactly in Dearborn or Michigan because we don't actually have the count yet, which is strange that somebody's hiding those numbers for all the third-party candidates. I'm not saying hiding. I don't know. But we will try to let you know what percentages he got. And he is not giving up, of course, as none of us should, even if we were Obama supporters who won the presidential election. Obama, those in power from Michigan, mostly Democrats now, they need our help and direction, even if we didn't vote for them, to straighten out things in the future. Let them know your opinions. Don't stop being involved just because you voted. If you did vote, that's wonderful, but that's not enough. We have to stay involved and stay educated, and we're doing what we can here at WHFR, of course, to keep the information flowing for you, and there's many other good sources. Don't forget your local papers, of course, your weekly papers, especially Dearborn Press and Guide and Dearborn Times-Herald here in Dearborn, because they will do what they can, I'm sure, to keep you in the know. Just two quick stories here with only about a minute to go. Ned, this morning...
The New York Times. Mm-hmm. We're talking about cars, and we're talking about Mr. Nader. And this is today's latest news, November Friday, the 8th. This says the 8th. Bill Valsack and Nick Bunkley. The Ford Motor Company, battered by the weak economy and a shift in consumer preferences, said today that its automotive business lost $2.9 billion in the third quarter and announced more cuts to conserve cash, including another 10% reduction in salaried payroll costs and lower capital spending. Ford said that it burned through $7.7 billion in cash in the third quarter, leaving it with $18.9 billion at the end of September, as vehicle sales in the United States plunged amid historically weak levels of consumer confidence and tight credit markets that have prevented some consumers from obtaining loans.
Yeah, we have to cut that off right now, Ned. Ned's not watching the clock here because I've got the clock in front of me. But Ford does have a plan to go ahead, even with 2,200 more layoffs. It's really sad, I think they were the best positioned of any of the so-called big three, and of course there's only three to talk about, but we'll have to wait and see how that goes. That was just a press conference today, and today is November the 7th. Now, maybe that won't be in the New York Times until the 8th, until tomorrow's edition, but today is the 7th all day. You can listen to this show, all of the journal shows, over again from our website, whfr.fm. Highly recommend that you and your friends take a listen to download the show from today and take a listen again to the Ralph Nader comments, not because it's sour grapes, but because it's the ongoing issues that matter, I think, the most right here in Dearborn in the near future. And tell President Obama and the other Democrats what you think they need to do, however you decide those issues. Don't give up the struggle. Politics is ongoing. Nothing is over with. It's always more that we need to do to straighten things out. Thanks for listening today on the new WHFR Journal. Thanks, Ned Apigian, to sitting in with me and giving his comments. We'll be back again next Friday.